Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So there was no better guest, as I'm sure you'll all know, having seen my previous interviews with the wonderful Power Scene American analyst Omar Badar, than this, the current guest who I just introduced. I've interviewed him two or three times now, and we've got a lot to talk about, to say the least. We last spoke, I think, back in January, I think, and this hideous obscenity has descended into even darker depths since we spoke. But it's a big honour to be able to speak to you again. So, hello.
Yeah, thank you so much. No, I really appreciate the platform as well. And it is indeed a horrific situation that, you know, we can't possibly ignore. And I appreciate you bringing attention to it.
No, it's obviously crucial, and you know, whatever horror I feel is obviously magnified for you. So, you know, it's always a huge honor to be able to speak to you. You know, let's speak with Iran, and it's, you know, before we came on, we were talking about there could be an impending Iranian strike, and you know what that means for this part of the conversation. So, as things stand, Iran has not responded in a military sense, though clearly Israel is trying to goad Iran into a military response after particularly the bombing of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. I have to say, I mean, people just often lose a bit of perspective here. Whatever people think about the Iranian regime, park that. If the British embassy was bombed in a foreign country by another power, or the American embassy somewhere was bombed, can you literally just imagine, everyone, there would be a military response very quickly. So what's going on here? I mean, Netanyahu is trying to regionalize this war, isn't he? So what's that all about? Tell me what you think.
Sure. No, I think this is exactly right. We are in a situation in which there is one goal that Israel is succeeding in achieving in Gaza, which is to destroy Gaza and punish the civilian population, in the hopes of making Gaza unlivable and finding a way to, again, to quote Benjamin Netanyahu himself, thin out the population in Gaza. That onslaught and that horrific project is ongoing and it is effectively succeeding. But the underlying strategic goals that Israel had announced to the world in terms of defeating Hamas and ending their rule in Gaza and retrieving the hostages, none of these seem to be on the horizon 6 months into a campaign, you know, that is far longer than any kind of conflict that Israel had engaged in before. So there is a clear failure. They are no closer. They're feeling completely impotent in terms of being able to produce an image of victory to the Israeli public. And in the face of that, they are looking for ways out. And one possible way out is to widen this confrontation, to take the pressure that Netanyahu is currently feeling from his own population. I'm sure you've seen the massive protests that we've seen everywhere, of people demanding a deal that would retrieve the hostages, and Netanyahu cannot afford to do that. He knows what the ultimate consequence of behaving reasonably here would be, which is to refocus attention on himself and his personal failures. So he is looking for a regional confrontation with Iran, specifically looking to drag the U.S. into a confrontation with Iran, because I don't think Israel would fare very well in a regional confrontation without U.S. and Western backing. And we've seen this extremely provocative attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. I mean, you'd have to be insane to imagine that Iran would not respond. So they are inviting an inevitable response. And Israel is already drawing all kinds of lines about what an Iranian response would trigger, saying that if an attack occurs from Iranian territory, then Israel is going to respond in Iranian territory as well. They're raising the stakes substantially. And they are basically trying to squeeze Iran into a situation where either they capitulate completely or they find themselves on this risk of a major regional war. Because Iran does not want a regional war. It does not serve its interests. They frankly would prefer for things to remain somewhat calm and put together. But you can't kill Iranians in a consulate in a foreign country and not to expect a response. And the most tragic part of this, Owen, is that the U.S. engagement on this has been absolutely just despicable. First, there is no condemnation of bombing of a foreign country's embassy or consulate. That in itself seems a little bit ridiculous. But on top of that, you have the U.S. Secretary of Defense committing the U.S. to defending Israel from any Iranian response. Keep in mind that Netanyahu did not give the U.S. heads up about the fact that this strike was happening. So you're basically saying that Netanyahu has the ability to drag the U.S. into a war whenever they feel like it, because we're committing themselves, we're committing the United States to tolerate whatever provocations Israel engages in, and still committing to also defending them from any repercussions from these kinds of actions. This is all an extremely dangerous situation. A regional war that involves direct confrontation between Israel and Iran would have absolutely devastating consequences for the entire region. It's not something that can be taken lightly. And we are looking at potentially, not exaggeration, millions of deaths if we have a war that gets completely out of control in the region. It's a very, very dangerous situation.
Wow, that really is chilling. I mean, in terms of why we think this, in terms of the context. So we have A, Benjamin Netanyahu who wants to drag this out so he's not removed from power and possibly ends up in jail. B, the strategic defeat. We've seen, obviously, the apocalyptic horror unleashed against Gaza and its people. 6 months, Israel, a military which styles itself as one of the world's most advanced, an area the size of East London, and yet they haven't defeated Hamas after 6 months. I mean, there was a report in an Israeli newspaper, I think it was in Ynet, it was after the withdrawal from Khan Yunis, 90% of it destroyed, and then it reported that Hamas had regained control over the ruins. So it just goes to show. So you've got that, and then you've got the US not using, we'll talk about this, its leverage and still doing lots of hot air and still facilitating this genocidal war, but nonetheless under a lot of domestic pressure. So that would, is that, I mean, that's kind of deals with that, doesn't it? You stage a war with Iran, you extend the war, keep Netanyahu in power, distract from Gaza in terms of the failures, including retrieving hostages. And also the US then will just, we've already heard from Biden, he said his ironclad support if that happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly pathological, what we're witnessing out of the Biden administration right now, and Biden personally himself having this deep emotional, ideological commitment to Israel, right or wrong. I mean, it's on a personal level really distasteful, but then when you translate it into official American policy, it just makes absolutely no sense. The American people did not sign up for that. His own base did not sign up for that. There is significant opposition to the idea that the U.S. is going to continue arming and funding genocidal violence that Israel is imposing in Gaza. And this idea now on top of that, that U.S. troops might be committed to defend Israel in case this war spreads. I mean, just handing over policymaking and putting it in the hands of Netanyahu, a reckless person who will do anything for the sake of his own personal political survival. The fact that Netanyahu can then have significant leverage over what American policy is going to be and what American troops might be committed to or not is completely bonkers. It's crazy. And you've seen, to your point, there is growing domestic pressure in the United States. Opinions polls show it. You see it in the streets. You see it in protests everywhere. You see it in the fact that Biden can't speak anywhere without somebody interrupting and protesting the fact that he is arming and supporting this genocide. And as a result, I think Biden is taking note. But so far, this has translated into a shift in rhetoric from Biden, but not a shift in policy. That the tone of his voice, the way he engages on this issue, talking about the importance of an immediate ceasefire, how Netanyahu is not handling the situation well, and all of that. But ultimately, when push comes to shove, U.S. military funding for Israel continues completely unrestricted and unabated. And it's funny because we saw the signs of a first potential real consequence of American policy when they allowed for a U.N. Security Council resolution to pass demanding a ceasefire. The Biden administration instantly undermined themselves by going out and publicly saying that this was a symbolic act, that they don't really expect Israel to abide by anything, that this is not really a binding action, and that it doesn't mean anything. And it's just very strange. I mean, the insult to the intelligence of people who are complaining about American policy, that you think you can try to appease people who are angry by allowing a Security Council resolution to pass, but then instantly say, this is completely meaningless and symbolic, and Israel is welcome to do whatever the hell they want to do. It's just, it's utterly ridiculous that this is the context that we're living in right now.
I said it wasn't legally binding, and then various international lawyers had to point out, yes, it is, actually. Before I ask you about the domestic situation, I mean, it's really striking what you said there, millions of lives at risk. And I'm just wondering, partly, in terms of how this plays out, because you've got Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and it's been a long time. I mean, there's been kind of a low-level conflict been going on there all the way through the current war in Gaza. But in terms of a full-blown confrontation, that's not happened for a very long time now. And Hezbollah now is very different from where it was, say, in 2006. So I'm just wondering what do you think would happen in terms of how this escalates? Because you've got, obviously, Iran as a power. You've also got Hezbollah. What are the dynamics do you think it play in terms of how that could escalate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, in terms of where the physical battlefield would be, I think Lebanon is definitely in the crosshairs as the primary battlefield in this wider regional war, because Hezbollah, based in Lebanon, is the single most powerful ally that Iran has in the region. And because of proximity to Israel, also the biggest threat to Israel in terms of their physical capabilities. And the last time there was an all-out conflict between Hezbollah and Israel was in 2006, nearly 20 years ago. And even then, Hezbollah's threats that they would retaliate to any strikes on Beirut by striking Tel Aviv stopped Israel from actually striking Beirut. So that's the level of deterrence they had back then. And right now they are infinitely more powerful. They have far bigger rockets, precision guided. They can hit every point in all of Israel from north to south. And they're capable of producing very significant casualties and destroying infrastructure in Israel in ways that are similar of what Israel is capable of doing in Lebanon. So this is not to say that, you know, one side can defeat the other in any kind of conclusive way, but it is to say that any all-out war between Hezbollah and Israel would almost imminently mean massive, widespread destruction, both in Lebanon and in Israel. And that's a prospect that, again, everybody, any sane human being would be doing everything they possibly can to avoid. But you have a level of hubris, a level of arrogance, and a level of commitment to, you know, this need to put the Arabs back into their place, and that racist mindset of people like Netanyahu and Smotrich and the rest of them in that government, and Ben-Gvir, that they might actually be willing to go that far, and they might be willing to put the region in an extremely difficult situation for the sake of restoring what they describe as deterrence. But what they mean by deterrence is just simply everybody bowing their heads down and accepting that Israel is a country that is above the rules and above the law, that gets to do whatever they want without anybody ever challenging them, and just accepting that dynamic, which is just fundamentally unsustainable.
I think hubris is an excellent word to be using in the circumstances. And anyone who's familiar with Greek tragedies knows that's followed by nemesis, which can be, in this case, as you know, a very violent nemesis at that. In terms of the US domestic situation, which you've already alluded to. So a new poll came out by YouGov, which showed that 36% of Americans believe Israel is committing genocide against Palestinian civilians, compared to 34% who disagree. So that is obviously, there's a large number still in the not sure category, 30%. But amongst people under 30, 42% think Israel is committing genocide, compared to 24% who disagree, with 33% unsure. When it comes to Joe Biden's own voters, the results are overwhelming. 57% of Biden voters think Israel is committing genocide. Just 15% say it isn't. Trump supporters, 15% say genocide. 63% say it isn't. There's also, interesting, quite a big gender split. 37% of American women think Israel is committing genocide. 27% disagree. American men, 41% say it isn't. 35% say it is. Also, alongside race, white Americans, I don't think that's surprising, are far less likely to say it's genocide than Black and Latino Americans. I mean, just because some people, I shared this, and some people are like, how can they not be higher? How can not be higher? And I think two things that, I mean, you know what? When on October the 9th, when Gallant made his statement about human animals and blocking all of life's essentials, I called that genocidal rhetoric. And I paused at the time because I thought, is everyone just going to they're just going to think I sound absurd and ridiculous and extreme? We're now at the situation where in America, where support for Israel is almost like treated as an article of faith. And if you don't have unequivocal support, you kind of, you're deranged, lunatic and extremist. You're outside the parameters of normal political conversation. That's been the case for a while, hasn't it? Amongst the Republicans and the Democrats. And view that position has shifted, but also it's not like the American media is talking about genocide. That's not a discussion. So these figures are pretty striking, aren't they? The fact that now more Americans than not think genocide is being committed by a state armed and backed by the administration, with a vast majority of Biden's own voters thinking he is facilitating a genocide.
Yeah, it is absolutely remarkable. And that context that you're describing, Owen, is absolutely critical as well. we are talking about an environment in which American media across the entire spectrum is effectively doing PR for Israel at different degrees, right? You've got the right-wing media that just portrays Israel the good guys, Palestinians the bad guys, and every Palestinian death is either deserved or terrorists or human shields or all these tired talking points. And then you've got the more liberal end of the spectrum in terms of mainstream media that describes Palestinian casualties as unintended collateral damage, that Israel feels bad, that civilians are dying. That's kind of the framing. And across that entire spectrum, nowhere do we see real, meaningful accountability for Israeli actions or an accurate portrayal of Israel's intentions, which its leaders are stating quite openly and explicitly. This difference between Israeli bluntness, if you turn on Israeli media and you watch the discussions that are happening on their shows, the genocidal intent is extremely explicit. They are talking about mass murdering people in Gaza and about devastating the population there as punishment.
Including children. They're openly talking about children on Israeli television as we need to kill them because they'll turn out to be terrorists.
100%. That is the rhetoric, and that is completely normalized in Israeli society and in Israeli media. And it's reflected in actual policies on the ground. We've had multiple American doctors who have been to Gaza to try to help people. And they say that it's simply standard that you have young Palestinian children, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, with single sniper bullets to the head as the reason why they're dead. I mean, this is a policy of actually murdering the civilian population, including children, that is unfolding, but you would not know it watching American media. And on top of that, you've got the discourse in the American political establishment also across the entire spectrum, completely supportive, barring a few handful of exceptions. Bernie Sanders has finally come around now to talk about this policy as being unacceptable, Israel's policies being absolutely horrific and demanding an end to U.S. military funding for the Netanyahu government. That is a significant change that we had not seen before. You've got a handful of other senators doing the same. You've got a handful of members of Congress who are also using that similar rhetoric. But those are exceptions. And when they do say it, we fight tooth and nail to make sure that these statements get out there and that people know they're happening, because the coverage has been so completely awful. So between that political establishment being unrelentingly pro-Israel and media coverage being just as bad, it is quite surprising that Americans actually know that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. And that is in large part due to the fact that the images, that Israel's own savagery in Gaza is so blatant and so over the top that even all this propaganda that we're witnessing is not able to cover it up. And we see it in more specific examples. I mean, it's quite, again, horrific with the killing of the World Center kitchen staff. Just 7 internationals who are there to provide humanitarian aid to Palestinians get killed, and suddenly people start paying attention, because we got used to the dehumanization of Palestinians, that you can hear about Palestinians being massacred by the thousands and people don't bat an eye. But suddenly you catch on to the fact that Israel not only killed these international humanitarian activists, but that an Israeli drone targeted them and was chasing them deliberately from one car to the other. There's just no dispute about the fact that this is a deliberate act of murder. And frankly, the underlying reason for it is also unsurprising when you listen to Israeli politicians talking about wanting to bring Gaza down to its knees by blocking food and fuel and water and electricity. Clearly, the people who are helping get food into Gaza are violating that policy, and therefore eliminating them would be elementary common sense from the perspective of people who back Israeli policy as explicitly stated. So that's beginning to also get people's attention, that it's not just Palestinians dying, that this murderous policy is actually reaching people who look like Europeans, and therefore that ends up being a reason for people to open their eyes. As disappointing as it is that Palestinian lives are not valued, there is still a silver lining in the fact that people are at least paying a little bit more attention right now, because somebody like Jose Andreas, who leads the World Central Kitchen, has plenty of credibility in elite circles in Washington, D.C., and when he starts talking about this as a deliberate targeted killing, it's difficult for politicians to continue ignoring it entirely.
I mean, on that, I pointed this out, and, you know, I'm not doing this to attack him now, given the circumstances, but in the, I think, 10 days after this all horror began, a Spanish minister called out Israeli war crimes, including collective punishment, the intentional blocking of aid from getting in, and he denounced it on social media. I mean, he tweeted calling for her to be sacked, suggested that he was pro-Hamas and pro-Russia, implied that, he was someone who was obviously very well and backed Israel's onslaught. And he was someone very well disposed towards Israel. and now says this is a war on humanity itself, because he's obviously, his dogma has collided reality. And the other point about World Central Kitchen, it's not just the fact that, you know, they were tracking these people for days, by the way. The World Central Kitchen supposed to have a deal with the IDF. We can see why. This was a pre-approved route. Their location was shared. Their coordinates, they had World Central Kitchen in massive letters on the trucks. And as you say, they hit first and chased until they were all killed. Mm-hmm. But it's now come out that the commander who was dismissed from the IDF, as a Telegraph right-wing newspaper has revealed, that commander is a right-wing settler who in January wrote signed an open letter calling for aid to be cut off from Gaza. So the guy who blew up trucks, which caused international aid agencies to say they were going to stop operating, called for aid to be stopped from coming into Gaza. Yeah. You don't have to be a tinfoil conspiracy theorist, did you? I'm going to ask about starvation before I do, and the famine and the, yeah, the horrendous... Go on, sorry.
Before you get to that, just a quick word on Jose Andreas, because I think it's a really important one. He, frankly, is a quintessential example of what Western viewership of this is actually like, because there's nothing surprising about his perspective, that you view Israel as the good guys instinctively, regardless of the evidence. Surely they're fighting a war on terrorism, and surely anybody disputing their humanitarian intentions must be a conspiracy theorist or whatever. And it is only because he's had an interaction in which he could not look away and was forced to know the details, because an incident impacted people he knows on a very personal level, that he's finally seen the light. You honestly could just look at that as exactly what every person needs, is to be forced to actually look at the details and examine them for themselves, as opposed to relying on these preconceived notions of what Israel is, to be confronted by the reality of what Israel is today and what its government is, and how they behave and the rhetoric they use and the actions they take. You would come to very, very different conclusions. This entire silly idea that the Israeli government are the quote unquote like us and the other side is the terrorists is undermined by the fact that the Israeli government rhetoric is very openly racist and genocidal and murderous, and their actions are the very definition of terrorism, using violence against civilians, murderous violence against civilians, in order to change political outcomes and achieve political outcomes that they can't achieve otherwise. That is a government that can only be described as a terrorist organization, in my view. And yes, any kind of closer look that you take a look at it, that you have, and any kind of closer engagement that you have with examining those facts, can only lead to that inevitable conclusion, and it will open everybody's eyes to actually see it.
Absolutely. State terrorism of a grand scale, and he now is talking about the war on humanity, which he wouldn't have done, you're right, unless he'd suddenly been forced to collide with a reality. Before I ask you just more about, in terms of what's happening in Gaza, Donald Trump, not been talking about as much as I should have done, probably, to be honest. The presidential election is 6.5, just less than 7 months away, isn't it? Yeah. He's got every chance of winning, partly because as much as a lot of Biden supporters are going to spend their time screaming at people how morally outrageous they are, like they'll say to people who are disillusioned over this, you're a disgrace if you don't vote for this, it's your fault. How do you know? This is really often the well-known effective strategy to get people to vote for you. Call them like idiots and stupid and outrageous. We hate you. Vote for us or you're scum. We still think you're scum, but vote for us anyway. Donald Trump, though, could win. Now, what is going on with Donald Trump on this position? Because actually, he's not been that visible in lots of ways, but maybe actually that's because a lot of what he's saying has not been covered properly.
Yeah, I think it's funny because there is a deliberate attempt at this point of the American, again, political establishment, media establishment, the idea that they've given Trump too much leeway the first time around may have enabled him in doing so. And so there is, frankly, a lot less coverage of what Trump is saying and doing.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, he does have a very chance of actually winning, in large part due to Israel's backing of Israeli policies, that this is diminishing Biden's support in key states, swing states, that could actually determine the outcome of the election. And it's funny because there is a personal contrast between Trump and Biden in terms of the personal commitments. I don't think Trump cares about Israel one way or the other. Trump is exclusively interested in himself and could not care less about foreign policy issues on merit. Nonetheless, as opposed to Biden, of course, who has a very deep personal commitment to Israel, that much is obvious. But nonetheless, Trump understands how to manipulate the situation in his favor, and he understands where the Republican base is on this issue, which is far more extreme in terms of their pro-Israel sentiment. So he knows that this is a position that he should be taking, and he also knows how to get Biden in a tough situation. Trump has made note of the size of the pro-Palestine protests that have been taking place in the United States. Solidarity with Palestinians and with Gaza is something that Trump has remarked on. And I think as a result, he knows that this is a problem for Biden. And you find Trump now very cynically saying things like, I think it was just either yesterday he may have put out the statement, saying that Biden is, quote, 100% pro-Palestinian, and essentially saying that anybody who cares about Israel should be supporting Trump's presidency as opposed to Biden's. Again, it's quite laughable, the idea that 6 months of enabling anti-Palestinian genocide is the 100% pro-Palestinian position. And it just, you know, lets your imagination run wild to think of what's the anti-Palestinian position then that Trump is going to be advocating for. But also, I think he's goading Trump into displaying his pro-Israel chops. He sees that Biden is beginning to soften a little bit, at least in terms of his rhetoric. And by calling Biden anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian, he's effectively trying to push Biden to demonstrate that he's not, by pursuing even more aggressively pro-Israel positions, which would undermine Biden's support with his own base and actually increases the chances that Trump could capitalize on that and get himself to win the election. So the entire thing is incredibly cynical, but again, it's just to think of it from the perspective of people who care about basic decency and humanity and human rights, that you do have a genocide enabler running against somebody who's promising to be worse. It's an absolutely disgusting political climate in this country right now in terms of the options that are viable. And it shouldn't be that way, that if democracy is supposed to genuinely represent and reflect the views of the population, there should be candidates falling over each other trying to capitalize on the fact that Americans don't want support for this massacre and do want to see a ceasefire and do want to see this massacre end. And that's not at all where the political conversation is, which really highlights the limits, the imperfections, to put it even mildly, of American democracy, that just the views of the elites and American policy does not in any way reflect American public opinion on a very wide range of issues. And this is a very obvious one.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Strong same here. I just want to talk to you about a horrific expose. Well, brilliant expose about something absolutely horrific. I've covered it on this. It was by Plus 97T magazine. It's an Israeli-Palestinian magazine by the Israeli investigative journalist Yuval Abraham, based on 6 Israeli intelligence sources about an AI system called Lavender, which basically automates the killing of so-called low-level Hamas operatives, which is not actually defined in any meaningful way anyway, where it will kill up to 15 to 20 civilians per low-level so-called targets are deemed acceptable collateral damage. It's not even always clear if that target is home. And they even note themselves an inaccuracy in it. They drop dumb bombs, which kill vast numbers of people on the basis more high-tech bombs are expensive and they don't want to waste bombs, they say, on expensive bombs on these people. Includes the system where they wait for them to come home is where their kids and they kill them at home. Yeah. It's called Where's Daddy? I raised this. I was on Sky News the other week. Always a pleasure, never a chore going on British news television to talk about this issue and other issues. And they just didn't want to talk about it. It hasn't got the coverage it deserves. It's like industrialized extermination. Yep. What are your thoughts about it? Because
yeah, it's again, I mean, just words escape you to try to describe a system that is that horrific. I mean, look, it's a thinly veiled effort by Israel to cover for what it's doing in Gaza, right? They have every intention to destroy Gaza and to devastate the civilian population. But rather than openly state that this is their aim, they hand over the system to artificial intelligence to determine tens of thousands of speculative targets of where militants might be, and then say, we don't care about the civilian death toll, that you can raise the threshold to 20 people for lower level militants and, you know, more than 100 people for high level commanders. If you're having artificial intelligence pick tens of thousands of targets, and your policy is we don't care how many civilians we kill in the process, you can have the pretense that you're targeting civilians when everybody understands that what that policy describes is the mass slaughter of the civilian population of Gaza. That is what the system serves. And this idea of waiting for, again, speculative militants to be home, I mean, that's just a very transparent violation of international law, that combatants are combatants only when they are engaged in combat, when they are armed and engaging in hostilities. And if you're at home with your family, that's not a legitimate target by any stretch of the imagination. And if you do want to indulge Israel's idea that anybody who's even loosely affiliated with Hamas going home is still a legitimate target and that you can drop a bomb and kill them along with their family, that very same logic, if you extended it to October 7th, for example, when you think of all the military-aged people who were at the festival, you know, you could make the argument by that logic that these were also militants, and it would just change the entire conversation about this. And yet, when Hamas kills military-aged Israelis who are in a civilian context, everybody understands that that is terrorism, correctly, frankly. But when Israel does it, we give them so much leeway on the idea that, oh, well, this is where they can find them, and that's what you do. I mean, it's all incredibly cynical. And again, it is there is no hiding the fundamental racism that is underlying behind that discrepancy in the way that people judge Israel's actions versus Hamas's actions. Waiting for people in order to avoid engaging them on the battlefield where it's more difficult to kill them, to wait for them to be home in order to drop a dumb bomb and eliminate them along with their entire family. It's an absolutely horrific act. I just don't know how any person with any kind of moral sense can defend policies like that. Mm-hmm. And yet this is the stated Israeli policy being carried out thousands of times over and over and over again with devastating consequences. And people look at it and just kind of throw their hands up in the air and go, oh, well, you know, I guess nothing too different from what you expected, not even worth covering. That is an absolutely glaring and disgusting double standard. And it's leading to the very consequences that we are witnessing, which is that Israel is running rampant on this rampage all over the place, mass murdering people, leading to a very significant potential regional confrontation. And nobody's appreciating the magnitude of the situation. Nobody's pointing out the insanity of it, that the entire world now is on the cusp of a possible regional war that's going to be absolutely devastating. And it all stems from Western governments' inability to put, and actually not inability, unwillingness. I think we should be careful about the way we use those words. They are absolutely able to put an end to this disgusting and horrific massacre. They choose not to because they lack the backbone to stand up to the Israeli government and cut off the weapons supply. And that refusal to end Western participation in this massacre is bringing the world to the brink. And it's just utter madness that nobody's standing up and calling this out for what it is.
Related to that, I just wanted to talk about state-sanctioned famine, starvation. Famine is now, in fact, US officials come out and said that famine is now, has started. In northern Gaza, where people are either, well, people have been eating animal feed, but people have already been starving to death. I just want to just quote this from the London Times newspaper, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And by the way, this is not giving credit. You'll see why. Well, quite the opposite. In a column, one of the columnists who did not suppose they could have spoken out against the war in Gaza at the time when it started. They didn't. Perhaps the greatest tragedy is that this was all predictable. It was like watching a slow-motion car crash. On October 9th, the Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, promised a complete siege in Gaza with no electricity, no food, no fuel. The next day, he told Israeli troops he'd released all restraints. Gura Island, a former Israeli general, wrote the same month, to make the siege effective, you have to prevent others from giving assistance to Gaza. Other such statements form the backdrop to all that has happened. They plagiarised that from my column. I'm not even joking. They took it from my column 4 days earlier, which I wrote in The Guardian. I know that because they put the whole thing, they even used, wrote the same month. And they, he actually said Gjura Island released all the restraints. I missed out the and they replicated my error. The point I'm making there is, okay, this is the point I'm making. This is the biggest scandal in modern Western journalism. And that is a bar to have to cross. There was the Iraq War.
Yeah.
I'm not letting the Western media off the hook in terms of other scandals. The reason I'm saying that, and you've already said this earlier in this interview, is, and a point actually made by the brilliant, what's his name? The associate, he's an Israeli-American associate professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies who I've interviewed. Why have I just forgotten his name? He's a brilliant scholar. The point he made to me was intent is so rarely explicit in the way that it is in this particular case. And it was from the very beginning. They said what they were going to do. They didn't go, you don't have to go through leaked documents. It's not like, you know, they were like, no, no, you know, like in Iraq, they were like, no, it's humanitarian. We're going to save Iraqis from Saddam Hussein. Woo. They were like, no, we're going to starve the population. And we think they're all guilty. We don't believe there are any innocent civilians. And we're going to starve them and deprive them of all the basic rights. And we're going to wipe Gaza off the map. But they said that over and over again, over and over again. Literally every day. Defense minister, cabinet ministers, politicians, backbenchers, media outlets, generals, soldiers.
And
none of these quotes I just read, I did a search in October, almost not a single newspaper or media outlet in the US or here quoted them. It's as though these quotations happened in another universe. They weren't relevant somehow. But you only had to listen. This is the point to what they said from the start. They're just doing what they said they were going to do. And now Israel has starved the place to death. And even now, supposedly leverage is being used. Trucks going in. Apparently Israel are making them so they're only half full. There's not roads there. They've bombed them. They're blocking them from going into northern Gaza. You know, the headline today in The Guardian, aid still not reaching Gaza, as top US official warns families. So they're starving them to death on purpose, yeah, as they promised. Sorry, yeah. It's just ludicrous.
It's absolutely infuriating. And the thing, Owen, is we remember that kind of just shamelessness from Donald Trump. I mean, with Donald Trump, he would lie about the most trivial and transparently false things. It rained during his inauguration, and he claimed that there was no rain. You can watch the video. It was raining. He claimed his crowds were bigger than Obama's. You put up the pictures. It's not even close. And his willingness to just say, I don't care that the evidence is overwhelming, I'm just going to lie and insist on lying, was kind of a shocking thing to watch. And we watched American media make fun of Donald Trump for it, that his capacity for lying is just incredible. And yet we don't see that same commitment to truth being applied in this case of even mocking Israeli officials for claiming things that they themselves have undermined by claiming other things just 5 minutes before. And so we do find ourselves in the situation in which Israel's intent is declared as to starve the people of Gaza. You have humanitarian organizations across the entire world, every single major and credible independent source, confirming that they are preventing aid from going in. But then when Israeli spokespeople get on Western media and they're asked about this, they go, oh, no, we don't know what you're talking about. We're letting all the aid in. Hamas is stealing it. Just there is not even an attempt at trying to come up with a plausible argument to explain their behavior. They're just blatantly lying and counting on the fact that American journalists and hosts are not going to have a follow-up question in which they call out these lies. That's how you create that level of comfort with lying. It is, honestly, you can reduce this entire ugly, despicable crisis beyond just this point, by the way, in Gaza, but much longer, as a problem of American-provided impunity for Israel. That Israel gets to do whatever it wants. You can't bring votes against them at the UN Security Council because the US would veto them. You can't try to provide any level of meaningful accountability that would impact Israel's behavior because the US will continue sending weapons. And that has taught the Israelis that they can do whatever they want, genuinely without consequence. And that, frankly, has encouraged streams of extremism in their thinking, that the level of blatant, open anti-Palestinian racism that is expressed day in and day out by this government is so blatant, and the level of lying that they're engaging in also is a reflection of that, that because the American political establishment provides impunity for Israel in terms of policy, you've got this default position among American journalists and media outlets to also provide Israel with the benefit of the doubt and never challenging their claims. And that kind of impunity really allows this horror that we're witnessing to actually unfold before our eyes. And there's no doubt in my mind that future generations are going to be looking back at this moment and wondering how the hell did the world stand there and do nothing, and what it meant for all these governments that claim to champion freedom and democracy and human rights and humanity and so on, that they have facilitated this absolutely horrific massacre in the face of open, transparent lies, and were never willing to challenge it with anything meaningful beyond the occasional word of criticism about how maybe Israel's gone too far and maybe it's time to let some more aid in or whatever. Honestly, it's exactly. And even this rhetoric about how many trucks Israel is letting into Gaza, as you pointed out, the roads are destroyed. The ability to physically distribute aid in Gaza is nearly impossible right now. You do need an end to this slaughter in order for us to be able to get humanitarian aid around. But even short of that, this endless debate about how many trucks are let in, is it 500, it was 200, and is that too much or is it too little, and are they empty and are they not? There's a more fundamental question that nobody's asking, which is, who the hell gave Israel the right to regulate how many trucks go into Gaza in the first place? It is not Israeli territory. Israel should have no say in what goes in and out of Gaza and how much of it goes in and out. And to be stuck in the confines of a debate about how much they're letting in and not, I think is ceding a much more fundamental point about the fact that Palestinians ought to be a free people. They're not children under the guardianship of Israel that Israel gets to decide how much food they get. Just this entire relationship is so fundamentally broken that we've come to internalize and accept to a great degree the idea of Israeli control over Palestinian lives. Can you imagine a situation in which Hamas is determining how much food Israelis get to eat, and that the debate would be hosting a Hamas spokesperson on CNN to talk about, well, we've let in this many trucks, so that's how many, you know, nobody would put up with that kind of conversation. Everybody would instantly say, get your hands off of what Israelis get to eat and not eat. And that's the conversation we should be having here. It should not be about the number of trucks or how much they've let in or not. It should be that they should have no say whatsoever in what Palestinians have access to, and that the only obligation Israel has at this point is to get the hell out of Gaza and to end that blockade that has existed for a couple of decades before the crisis that we're in actually even unfolded.
The radical concept you've introduced here into the that Palestinians are actually human beings of equal worth, which is obviously something which is not even on the radar of the media coverage. It's not even, I mean, it's astonishing from the start to finish, the lack of subtlety of even engaging in the point you just made, which should be central. Just before I ask the final final point in terms of where things are at, you know, it's notable as well that Israel has destroyed much of the domestic food production and agriculture. So when people talk about the aid going in as the destruction of the road, they're not taking into account that the need is much greater for so many reasons, partly because of Israel's genocidal warfare. David Cameron, of all people, the British Foreign Secretary, one of the only costs Israel has had to pay is sacking their spokesperson, Ilan Levy, when he said unlimited aid was getting in. And then the British Foreign Secretary, still arming them, made the point that Israel was putting up loads of blocks to stop aid from getting in, contrary to what Ilan Levy said. Just finally, I mean, I know there's an article that you pointed to, which I've seen as well, which is, I think it was in NPR, which was about, I suppose, a shift to low-intensity warfare, that the number of Palestinians being violently blown apart, as well as those maimed, including kids being amputated without anaesthetic, that's decreased in the recent period. Now, I mean, notwithstanding the fact that we've seen Khan Yunis, 90% destroyed. We see the prospect, obviously, of a violent assault on Rafah. But in these sorts of horrors, it isn't even the violent deaths that, in the end, kill the vast majority of people. They destroyed the healthcare system. The aid's not getting in. I mean, just the healthcare system's a daily death sentence for a lot of people. Cancer patients, people with heart problems, people who are infirm, pregnant women, newborn babies. You could go on. Just what do you think? This whole narrative that actually the number of massacres is not quite as high as it was.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the article described it as low intensity warfare at this point. And when you think of the number comparison, right? I mean, just in the past day, more than 80 Palestinians have been killed. The day before that, 65 Palestinians had been killed. By any normal standard, under quote unquote normal circumstances, any one of these days would be a horrific massacre that ought to grab the world's attention as a horrific massacre. And yet it doesn't, for two reasons. One is that Palestinians are the victims. That's the obvious reason. And the second is that we've gotten accustomed to a rate of killing Palestinians over the past 6 months, that committing massacres of this scale, where you're quote unquote only killing 80 Palestinians a day, that that's considered to be low intensity, speaks of, again, how much we've normalized the scale of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians as a norm to be accepted, that we roll along with as a tolerable status quo. Giving Israel the leeway to describe the current scale of massacres as low intensity only because they had been killing, you know, more than twice as many people every day before that, I think is a little bit crazy. I mean, at the height of this genocide, they were killing 136 children per day. And now, presumably, if you just want to do the statistical comparison, maybe they're killing 30 or 40 kids every day. That's still 30 or 40 children being massacred, 30 and 40 parents who are losing their children. This is still an absolutely horrific situation that is unfolding day after day. And I think in no universe should that ever be considered low intensity. The death of a single child due to violence that is being excused and supported by Western governments should never be described as low intensity. It is extremely intense and horrific and despicable and ugly and demands an immediate intervention. And I think that not normalizing that kind of rhetoric is really, really important. You can, by all means, if you want, point out that these massacres are, you know, killing this many people as opposed to that many people. But I don't think that that should be called as low intensity, especially when we have created a permanent situation now in Gaza in which Palestinian death toll is inevitably going to rise much, much higher. You have a situation in which thousands upon thousands of people are missing under the rubble. We don't know where they are. Someone I personally know just a couple of days ago discovered that their mother, who had been missing for a while, turned out to be dead. I mean, you can presume that the tens of thousands of people who are buried under the rubble are probably dead. And that means that that number just by itself, in terms of who's already dead, is much, much higher than the numbers that have been circulating. And you add on top of that all the people who can't get medical attention, can't get healthy food, can't get clean water, and the inevitable rise in that death. That is an absolutely horrific situation. It is extremely intense and desperately in need of an intervention of some kind to put an end to the slaughter. And even with our best efforts, if you could get a ceasefire in today, if you could stop this massacre today and flood Gaza with aid and medical support, that death toll is still going to rise because it is too late, that you can't keep up with the rate of the destruction and desperation that is currently unfolding. And again, it is all only possible because Western governments that claim to represent their people, that is effectively speaking in our name and spending our money, have enabled this massacre to take place and continue enabling it. It's a call for every person of conscience to stand up and demand and scream as loud as they possibly can that this has to come to an end.
Amen. Very, very powerful words. And just on that, after October 7th, it became fashionable to extrapolate the figures if you imposed them on the size of the US population. And I would note that, for example, if 80 Palestinians in Gaza are killed, if you adjust for population, that's equivalent to over 12,000 Americans a day being violently murdered in warfare. And obviously, you know, the points you made, buried under the rubble, the latest estimate is around 20,000 buried under the rubble, on top of the official death toll of approaching 35,000 now. So that would obviously increase it dramatically. People who've been killed, who've died, the excess deaths. I mean, I interviewed the Palestinian Christian Khalil Sayeg, who's he's a Palestinian Christian analyst, whose father died of a heart attack because he didn't get any aid, so he died. It's those sorts of examples, isn't it? It's this destruction of medical health, lack of food, people starving to death, and that's why people, we talk about excess deaths, which is quite a grim clinical term, but it refers to the overall who's dying as a result of the conflict, and it's much, much higher. Horrible, horrifying stuff. But Omar, as ever, you're such a sage voice, full of so much depth and more clarity, which is the term, as my listeners know, I use all the time when it's appropriate. So it's been a real honor as ever. So everyone, please do share this video, leave your comments, do like, subscribe, obviously. But Omar, thank you so much as ever. You've been always a brilliant voice. Someone I always look to for, you know, analysis, thoughts about what's happening. And I'll obviously advise everyone to keep doing so. And obviously we'll speak to you soon.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And I'll just say one last thing in closing, something that I also feel like I...
Yeah, please do.
I watch your debates with other people on British television and many other places. And your courage and willingness to take absolutely... Are you allowed to curse on this platform?
Curse, yeah, straight away. Yes.
Your willingness to take absolutely no shit from anyone when you can tell that they're using propaganda talking points and attempting to bully you into silence by using all kinds of tropes. You standing up for them the way that you do and insisting on telling the truth, no matter how uncomfortable and how controversial, it to me is a sign that your prominence in light of all that is a sign of the fact that the discourse is shifting, that people like you do have a platform and a voice on more and more mainstream outlets to engage in these absolutely critical conversation. And I certainly look at that as a very promising sign. I want to thank you for the voice that you yourself have provided by speaking out, and also the platform that you provide for other voices speaking truth about this very critical issue right now.
Well, that means a huge amount coming from you. Honestly, it means a huge amount. I'd never forgive myself for anything else. And, you know, what I always say is if Palestinian journalists are being butchered on the ground in Gaza, if they can speak out, whatever cost people think they're going to suffer in, you know, here I am sitting in central London in my flat with my cats, you know, it is nothing will ever compare to what, you know, to what they've gone through. So yeah, Omar, it's a big honor. Thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you. Take care.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.